So I'm sure you've been hearing about the recent settler violence that's been going on,
Nope.
right?
What about it?
Well, you know, the settler violence has been increasing and stuff like that in the West Bank. I'm just kind of wondering, because you support Israel as a whole, how you sort of detach their clear support for the settlements, which are blatantly against international law, while also kind of justifying your support for the current government,
It's really difficult to
essentially.
do it. Generally, like for supporting a country, it usually means I support like every single thing that every single part of the country does, what the government does. So, like for instance, like I support slavery in the United States when we did it, and I support like all the war crimes and Abu Ghraib and everything. So I don't know. I'll probably have to think about it for a while, and maybe figure out like a more coherent position on it. But yeah, it's a very difficult decision to kind of come to.
It's all or
I
nothing,
mean,
yeah.
what do the Israelis that you talk to that you're friends with say about it? Like, do they give, I'm just curious as to their insight on or their opinions on kind of the settler stuff. Are they largely opposed to it in your experience from what you've seen,
Well,
or?
most Israelis I know are largely opposed to it, but that's because I know like left-wing people. But so anybody that I know is going to be on the left in Israel. If I had to totally vibe out a bullshit guess, it's going to be probably 20 to 40% of people in the left in Israel are like opposed to it. And then there's like some 20 to 40% on the right that are all for it, as long as it moves those people eventually out of the West Bank because they don't want to see them. And then there's going to be some chunk of people in the center who maybe kind of think it doesn't look that good, but they feel like given the reverse, the Arabs,
When you say
the
opposed to
Palestinians
it,
would
does
do
that
it to
mean
them regardless, so they don't give a fuck, is my guess.
but when you say opposed to it, you mean opposed to building anything in the settlement areas, or opposed to like bulldozing a home and
Opposed to
then
like the
building?
violence or whatever.
Okay, I see. That makes a little bit more, because I was just trying to, like, you know, I'm trying to be a little bit more open-minded about the whole Israel thing, and it's just something I can't really see past. I don't understand how, you know, you're supposed to support the government when they're clearly backing these sort of settlements and things like that. But so I was curious to get your insight, because you seem like a level-headed and reasonable person. So I was kind of wondering how you sort of separate the two. But I guess it seems like it's difficult for you as well when you think about it in
Is
a
this guy
sense, but
retarded or I'm
he's
sorry,
one of my most special
catching
chatters.
up. Oh.
Why is that retarded, Dan? How is it
You
retarded?
think you have to, do you agree 100%
Yes.
with Biden, with every single thing he's done?
Of course not.
Okay, then how the fuck can you support him?
Biden hasn't done anything that's nearly as, I think, drastic or evil, right? As like bulldozing. Like, there are cases of clear settler violence where the police or whoever is in charge will refuse to prosecute the people that
You
committed it, right?
misspoke.
If Biden did something like that, if Biden did something like that, then I wouldn't support him, right? If someone burned down a home and maybe even killed someone or harmed someone, and Biden advocated for his release, yeah, I would not support him holistically, right? You can disagree on certain things, but there's certain things that you can't just disagree on, I think, right?
Okay, ready? This is a total fucking waste of time because nobody gives a fuck and nobody cares, and because Jews are involved anyway, so who cares?
True.
Okay, this is the little dotted bullshit is the West Bank. When people talk about the settlements, there are like two different types of things that we're talking about, and both sides will conflate these things because they both have reasons to conflate them. So there's two different things we're talking about with the settlements. The vast majority of people, I want to say I'm making this number, but I think it's like 80 to 90% or something of Israeli quote unquote settlers live near something called the Green Line. The Green Line is are the borders that demarcate the West Bank. It's the armistice line from the 1948 war. Okay. Most
And it's
settlements,
called the Green Line.
I think they refer to it as the Green Line. Most settlements are
Okay.
along that Green Line. Okay. There are the people that like live here are. I think Israel considers it non-negotiable. Like those people are never being moved. And I think that like even at least historically, like most Palestinians for negotiations or whatever wouldn't care much about these settlements. Like you could just move this green line east a little bit and land swap and it would be about even. These people are generally not out there murdering people. They're not out there doing crazy shit. They're just like they live near, it's cheap land basically. If you go to Israel, you don't want to live in fucking Tel Aviv or Jerusalem. It's too expensive or whatever. You can live in one of these settlements and it's like it's on the green line. You're not like attacking Palestinians daily, whatever, okay? But then you have these like deeper settlements. The ones that get talked about the most, just because I've been there, I guess, would like Yitzhar is one of these like deep settlements. You have to drive in for a while and you get to one of these settlements. These deep settlements are the ones that are in. They're the ones that have like the crazy gates, the crazy Jewish people that live there with the crazy hair.
That's like 10%
Yeah,
of the actual
those are
settlers.
the people who are out there like stirring shit up. Those are the people who will go out there and try to like set up tents so that they can start claiming land against Palestinians that live out here in the West Bank. Now, on the right, the super Zionist people like to call all settlers the same because they know that it's more morally defensible to defend the Green Line settlers. So they will conflate the Green Line settlers with the like the deep settlers because they know that it's that most people wouldn't want the Green Line settlers moved. So they always conflate these two groups. They call all of them the settler people or all of them part of the settlements. People on the pro-Pali side on the left like to conflate all of them because they know that it's very difficult to morally defend the deep settlers. So they like to conflate the Green Line settlers with the deep settlers. All of these people just get called settlers, but in my opinion, these are two very different groups of people. People who live on the Green Line are just, like I said, it's usually, especially if you birthright to Israel, you want to move to Israel, this is like really, really, really cheap area to live in, and like you can live there. Some of it, like they built a wall after, I believe, the Second Intifada. They built a wall to separate the West Bank from Israel. There is a wall that is a little bit even to the east of the Green Line. So there are people that live in settlements in Israel. Some of these people don't even know they live in a settlement because it's west of that wall. They don't even live past the wall, right? That's what I'm saying. Now, regardless of whether or not you think it's right or wrong, okay, I don't care. But it's a different, these are different types of people than the deep settlers. That's all I'm saying. The deep settler people are the ones that will stir shit up. They'll fight not only Palestinians, they'll fight the IDF because the IDF generally tells them to chill, but because they know that they cause shit. What did you ask me? Why did I explain that? I don't like the deep settler people. I think they should all be nuked. I don't give a fuck about any of them. But there's no, nobody is ready to make a deal on either side of this that involves any kind of real negotiation. So all you have are...
Is there a name for settler people that the Israelis refer to them as or something? Or
I don't know in Israel if they have formal distinctions between these two.
You have a final hearing of like a clear distinguishment between the two types of settlers, right?
Like, I wish I could... I don't want to shit on anybody, but like when I went to Israel, there was a settlement that I went to and it was like a bunch of Americans. It felt like I was in like a like white person suburbia. Like it was just like we ate normal food and everybody was just like chill or whatever. This is a Green Line settlement. But when you saw the video of me and Lonerbox getting basically pushed out by some weird fucking dude with an AK-47 who looked like he was inbred or whatever, that was a settler from Yitzhar. The crazy people, just from my experience, the crazy people, and then generally if you think about it, the crazy people all live in these deeper settlements. Oh, somebody said that we call them hilltop youth.
Okay, that makes a little bit more sense. And then you probably don't know too much about what the government is doing to combat these people. I mean, the current government's obviously pretty far right. But...
So Sharon is known as a conservative prime minister. He was the prime minister that presided over a lot of the Second Intifada until he had a stroke. Sharon was right wing, but Sharon hated the settlers. However, there was money that was being funneled through Sharon's government illegally to a lot of settlements out in the West Bank. And there was a huge thing that came out, a huge report. I wish I could remember the name of the lady that was the head of this report. Somebody might have it, a commission or whatever, that found out that what was happening was, despite the fact that Sharon was telling people, you need to not be out here in the settlements, this needs to not happen. It's not that Sharon was secretly dictating that money should flow out to them. It's that people in the government were actually defying him and getting money to flow out to these West Bank settlements, even though Sharon didn't like it. Now, Sharon didn't hate these deep settlements because Sharon was a charitable man whose heart bled for the Palestinians. He didn't like them because he saw the West Bank as the death of Israel, because if Israel continued to fuck around in the West Bank, they would lose themselves as a country. Sharon was the guy who did the unilateral disengagement from Gaza, where he ripped all the Israeli settlements out of Gaza to the chagrin of all the Israelis there and to the huge upset. He also wanted to leave the West Bank completely too, but he couldn't do it. He didn't have the time to do it. He pulled a couple out, but not many. But yeah, so yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't think it was the death of Israel, just because like in the region, everybody's going to attack him forever.
Because Israel was entering a problem that was going to be intractable. There was literally no way out. Israel was never going to absorb the Gaza Strip or the West Bank into the Israeli country proper, because there are too many Arabs that live there. So the Jewish people would lose their demographic majority. But if they continued to play this dual game of indefinite occupation without any end in sight, it would just lead to the destruction of the country, which is the number one source of probably political instability, I don't know, maybe in the entire Middle East. Like, wouldn't Sharon have serious exit space today if he was alive today? No, Sharon, I would say, would be vindicated. Sharon said 25 years ago, whatever, or 20 years ago, Sharon was like, we need to just fucking leave, just unilaterally disengage from the West Bank and fuck it, make our borders, let them figure their own shit out and then be done with it. And then you would have a Palestinian state between Gaza and the West Bank, or it'd be two different countries for Palestinians, or maybe Egypt or Jordan would absorb them again. I don't know, but yeah.
All right, I have one more question.
What's up?
Off topic. So I have these friends I grew up with. They're all really smart people, really great people. Right, but when it comes to politics, they're pretty retarded. So I'm kind of wondering why you think people who are like intelligent in areas like engineering or tech will say things like, you know, Trump is just corrupt as Biden and there's no difference between the two, or video games suck because they're being liberalized It's like, I remember talking to one of my friends and he told me about how he hates games nowadays because, or, you know, games suck nowadays because of the political correctness and stuff or something like that. And then I said, oh, do you know any games that suck now because they're like really feminine or politically correct? Think of any video games, right? So why do you think like people who are really intelligent fail to apply any sort of basic kind of reasoning when it comes to this sort of stuff? Is it just more, do you think it's just more fun?
There's two things. One is called epistemic trespassing. You're competent in one area, and then you assume that that competence carries over to another area, even though it doesn't. But the second bigger thing I've been talking about more and more recently, okay? And you know what? I finally got to experience this firsthand for the last few days, okay? Every motherfucker on the planet hates Hassan Piker. He is the least popular person ever. When I open my Twitter, I see politicians attacking him. I see influencers attacking him. I see tweet after tweet after tweet of people just going in on him. Okay.
It's true.
It's not true, though. What happened was, no, it's not true. So what happened is, finally, some Democratic politicians, like there's like two of them, have started calling out Hassan. And so I started retweeting these people. And I noticed that after 2 days of doing this, my feed is wall to wall Hassan haters. If I was not like a media, news, internet savvy person, I would just assume, wow, I guess the entire fucking world really hates Hassan Piker. If I go check my feed, it's all anti-Hassan stuff. I think that people are severely undercounting how insane it is to have all of your news routed through algorithms that are showing you headlines that you want to see. Like, I'm checking... Like, even people are attacking the Pod Save America guys now. I'm like, oh, this is awesome. What?
These people don't even watch or keep up with the news. They're not, you know, they don't really care about politics and stuff like that. They just have these opinions that, like, video games suck now because women, like, you know.
No, but they do. Everybody, unfortunately, is connected to the news because they probably have some social media where they thumbs up or thumbs down something, and then that's it. That's the point, right?
Right, I suppose.
Yeah. They only have to see one or two of these videos, and then they get fed more and more and more.
Well, that's their whole algorithm at this
point. Wow, yeah. Another tweet. Hassan's prediction comes true. One of his followers commits an act of terror. Oh, cool. Everybody hates Hassan, I guess. Hassan defended Russia annexing Crimea. That's not anti-war. Wow, cool, right? But I'm saying that this is just like one day. I think I started retweeting a couple politicians, and now my whole feed is this. So if I had no idea what was going on in the media, I might just assume, oh, cool, I guess every single motherfucker must hate Hassan now.
I think the majority of Americans do hate him now. But yeah, especially after the dog.
The majority of people probably still don't know who he is. I think he's getting some heat online now for sure. But I'm just saying that, like, regardless of what the truth is, it's not this what the algorithm is showing me, right?
Right. Yeah. If you were going off of your algorithm, it's good. Well, yeah. I mean, the posts they do come across constantly are pretty convincing as well. Like, he was telling me about how, you know, on Black Ops 6, they added like a girl cafe or something like that because one of the female devs wanted it. They're fed stuff like that constantly. But I'm just surprised that you can do like, you can solve like Fourier series in your third year of engineering, and then your chain of logic is, well, Trump is just as corrupt as Biden. Biden just hit it more. Like that.
Yeah, but I mean, like, these guys also think that engineers could work well without management, and they all hate everything. Like, I mean, like, everybody is like narrowly interested in their field, and as soon as you venture outside of their field, they know nothing, right? Like, that's just pretty normal for people, and then you just get fed whatever bullshit. Yeah,
they're also probably Canadian, so
damn.
Well, yeah, they are Canadian,
but don't worry, you won't have to deal with these guys much longer because we're replacing all of them with AI. Hell yeah.
Now, they do low-level hardware stuff. AI can't really take over that stuff. They don't do, like, the high-level Python shit that anyone can do. So, okay. But yeah. All right. Well, thanks for your time. That was my two questions. Again, some different insights. So thanks. Thanks, Dan, as well. And Mutton or Mutton. Right. Mutton,
yeah. The question that, I mean, like, if you ever want to argue, but you can't because there's literally no substance on this, is you should just ask the pro-Palestinians, like, what is a reasonable settlement to everything or a resolution to everything? Because I think now, especially with how extremely far left the conversation got held hostage by, my assumption, I could be wrong on this, but my assumption is that most people who are pro-Palestinian now are opposed to the two-state solution. Most of them are in favor of a single-state solution.
What, you mean they're opposed to a two-state solution and they only want a Palestinian state? Is that what you're implying?
Well, it would be a combined state of Jews and Arabs, but I mean, it would essentially be a Jewish minority state, yeah. But that's what, because they would see a two-state solution as being oppressive to the Palestinians because it's less territory, it's not enough, and whatever, any restrictions that Israel would put on would be unacceptable. And
I mean, I can't really argue or reason with the pro-Palestinian people. I mean, yeah, their chain of logic is like, it's all occupied land sometimes, stuff like that.
Exactly, yeah, from the river to the sea, they want it all to be
Palestinian. It's counterintuitive too, because I'll say, like, okay, I mean, what has any of this stuff gotten the innocent Palestinian civilians. You know, it doesn't seem like it's propelled them anywhere.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter because the people in the West that are fighting don't have to suffer any of the consequences of the actions that they advocate for.
Yes, exactly. So. They don't have. They can go to like the university protests and stuff, but they're not the ones having rubble dropped on them constantly. You know, it's pretty disturbing, but you can't really do anything about it. So. I just assume they're good people, but they're heavily brainwashed. And then
most people by default are going to be goodish people. Yeah, they should be.
Pretty much. All right. Well, thanks for your time. I got to go tutor now.
But okay. Have fun.
Thank you.
Bye. Well, what do you want to talk about?
I wanted to clarify something with you before your conversation with Hutch. And I also want to talk about Supreme Court packing as well. And there was something on the Israel thing too. But yeah,
okay, go for the quick Hutch thing. What is it?
Okay. So I just want to make sure that I understand your argument with regards to like how to fix democracy. Is it sounds like what you want to do then is you want like, let's say Gavin Newsom becomes president and you want him to go, okay, motherfuckers, you want a dictator, I'll show you a dictator, and then have him do like a bunch of like all the shit that you listed in that email, even if it's not
okay,
like
no, never mind. Okay, what's the next topic? Next topic.
No, I was asking, is that actually what you want?
No, but I also, it's not worth it to hang by the top of the 50 minute time. Andrew's not going to argue about it tonight, and we'll have a better, more current position then. But okay,
what's flatten your his rhetoric?
Yeah, or what's the next, or what is it that you want to
the Supreme Court thing?
Yeah, what's the Supreme Court thing?
Okay. I think that packing the Supreme Court is a bad idea because as soon as you do it, then so what are you going to do? You're going to install like however many Supreme Court justices you need so the court's not conservative anymore, and then the next president is going to do the same thing, and so on into perpetuity. That's
okay. Wait. So real quick. What would be the downside of a Republican packing the Supreme Court? What would it do? There's like a very basic. I don't overthink this. It's a very basic question. Why would it be bad if a Republican packed the Supreme Court?
Because it would remove, because it would be taking the justices, or it would be removing the one big check that the court is supposed to be.
You're overthinking it.
It would be bad because then the Democrats would do the same thing.
No, you're overthinking it. It would be bad because then we would have a conservative court.
Yeah, that's also true, but that's not how I was thinking about it, really.
That's fine. It would be bad. Ideally, we wouldn't want them to pack it because it would be a super conservative court after they pack it.
Yes, it would. Yeah. And then we would want to do the same thing when we came
okay,
in.
Okay,
right?
Thinking, but I'm saying it would be bad because it would be a super conservative court. Okay. What is it right now?
Right now, it's a super conservative court. Okay. But like,
when will that change?
Probably not for a long time.
When you say long time, can you quantify that?
Like until like
30 years?
Like, yeah, probably 20 or how until like they start to retire. So like, yeah, for ages, because some of those people are not that old. Like the new guys are not that old. All the Trump ones.
Okay. So just to put things into perspective, I'm not even making a positive argument in favor or against anything, but we're worried about packing the court because if we were to pack the court, then a bad thing could happen. And the bad thing that could happen is the thing that we're already planning on having happen for the next 20 or 30 years. That's like what we're at now. We're going to have a conservative court for the next like 20 or 30 years, probably, right?
There are other reforms potentially that one could do to like I'm sure, I imagine, I don't know if it's possible or not, but if you could impeach Thomas and remove him, which you might be able to do, because I'm pretty sure he was up to some sus shit he took some bribes or he's got some, ethics violations. And if you got rid of him, then that would be one guy gone. Like, you should probably do some shit there to make it so that they can't, or so that, you know, like Supreme Court justices are held to higher ethics.
Okay, sure, but like, can't they, are you not worried that they would just impeach the liberal justices next? Why can't you make that same recursive argument for impeachment?
Only if the liberal justices did wrong things, then they could be impeached. Like this argument relies.
To be clear, impeachment is a political process. You don't really have to like be sentenced in a court of law or anything, right? Like you can.
Yeah, you can. Although I'd have to look into why Bill Clinton's impeachment failed because I don't know if the Democrats controlled the Senate at the time or if it was the Republicans.
Well, I believe you need a supermajority to convict in the Senate, right? You need 66 votes.
Yeah.
A lot
I don't
of
know
votes.
If they had that or not, because I'm not.
There's no way they have 66 Republican senators. If they do, I'll eat my own ass on stream.
Probably not, because that was a pretty rare thing. six, seven. I mean, I understand what you're saying, but like at the same time, there is a fear that like I think there's a reason why nobody would want to do that. Even so, like
yes, but what I'm saying is that fear is because of like what's already going to happen and what already is happening.
Well, I mean, the fear is that you're going to create a chain of escalation where then the next guy is going to do it. And you're basically going to turn the court into a rubber stamp.
You're saying escalation. Okay, but escalating to what? We're worried about a super conservative Supreme Court.
Well, no, not just that, but a court that would rubber stamp the president's agenda. Because even though right now the Supreme Court's not great, but they haven't like completely rubber stamped everything for Trump. I mean, they killed his tariffs, which was like his favorite thing, you know?
So they killed one form of the tariffs, but they... But they gave him immunity from crimes. They allowed,
yeah, I know.
Basically got rid of injunctions in a way.
Yeah.
They've held in some regards, but I mean, like a super PAC court could hold in some regards maybe as well, possibly. Who knows?
I would imagine that wouldn't, because like when FDR was going to do it, the entire point was for him to get a bunch of justices in there that would have agreed with him.
Yeah, but right? It still had to be confirmed by the Senate, right?
Yeah, they did. But he had actually, the reason why he also didn't do it is because that like the Democrats in Congress didn't want to do it. And he had to pull back on that. I think because they all knew that doing that would have been a really bad idea. And it would have meant that the next president, if they were a Republican, would have done the same shit. Like, because you're talking about removing a check on the executive branch, which is what the court is supposed to be, by basically making them a rubber stamp. That's all I'm saying. Like, the rest of it is just...
Was that the argument at the time? I actually don't know what the argument was at the
time. I'm not sure if that was the argument at the time. I read about this a long time ago, but I don't remember a lot of it. I just remember there were some funny memes about the guy who apparently supported it and then or stopped supporting it because he was mad that FDR wasn't going to nominate him to the court, and then he went home and promptly like had a heart attack and died after he did like a long ass filibuster in the Senate, which I thought was kind of funny. But that's all that I remember about that. It's been like a couple years since I read anything about it.
Okay, well, anything else?
Cool. I've been working on a project with a few people on kind of this topic that we were just discussing. And the big thing is around kind of an idea of how to hold people accountable while still being liberal and trying to kind of solve a lot of problems at the same time. So specifically, this is to hold people in the Trump admin accountable, getting around the pardon, making it so that it's a long-term solution so that if people in the future do the same thing, they can be held accountable in the same way. And it is free from kind of the issues with checking and balances.
Yeah, what do you got?
Okay, just prefacing. So if we were able to get enough senators, and the Democratic president, we could sign on to the Rome Statute. Okay.
Okay.
I know. I'm not saying
the statute is
the Rome statute is the thing that gives you power to join the International Criminal Court, which is when you talk about like war crimes and everything, it falls under the Rome Statute.
Right.
Although there's going to be a huge issue here that I don't know if you guys have thought of, but we'll see. Go.
Okay. So one, we'd need to repeal and revise 22 USC 7423 and 7424, as well as probably a few other statutes that are kind of related to this. Mm-hmm. But if we have enough to sign under the Rome Statute, we'd have enough to do that.
Okay.
Then from there, what you would do is you would make it so that the Rome Statute basically would only have jurisdiction over people that have received presidential pardons.
Okay.
And then that way, basically, American citizens still aren't subject to it unless a president has pardoned somebody. And then by that point, we would say, okay, well, look, you know, Trump and all of them have been pardoned. The U.S. government is not doing anything to bring them to a U.S. court. They're being brought to the International Criminal Court. None of those International Criminal Court people are elected or appointed by anybody inside of the U.S., so any kind of like fascist regime within the U.S. wouldn't be able to control that court. Trump is doing everything he can to make everybody around the world hate him. By showing our support of the International Criminal Court, it makes us institution-pilled and promoting more institutions again. And then going forward, if anybody thinks, oh, I'm going to go in there and do that and I'll get pardoned, I'll get off with it, well, sorry, we have a way to get to you.
What if they were pardoned for just domestic crimes that weren't like war crimes?
Well, if they were just pardoned for domestic crimes, then so be it. But that's not like, if a person's only committed a domestic crime and they get pardoned for it, I'm not as worried about those people. I'm more worried about the people that are doing the pardoning and things like that. Like, to me, if we can take out the people at the top and show them that they're not invulnerable, that is more important.
Take out by holding them accountable, not just because you're using murder language.
By going to vote.org, yeah. Okay.
No, not so. Fucker. Whatever. I'll just brown and prison. No. Fuck you.
No, to go, you could get them in court, you know, hold them accountable by putting them in jail after that.
Sure, right? Okay.
Once they go through the SEC.
I love you, and I love that this is a creative idea, so this is going to be my big problem with it, okay?
I appreciate you being nice about it.
I am. I'm nice because I love you. Okay. I don't know if this exists in a domestic term or if it's just an international term. Have you ever heard of the term complementarianism? Is that a real thing?
Sure. Or you just want to talk about reciprocity, or is this something different than that?
So I think I'm using the right word. So in international law, I think the ICC and the ICJ both, I believe, operate under this concept of, I believe it's called complementarianism, where the idea is you're not really supposed to be ever prosecuted by the ICJ or the ICC. I know it's true for the ICC. I'm not as sure for the ICJ. Because they want your own local systems to have their first pass at holding people accountable. So let's say that it does come out that Netanyahu was personally raping Palestinian children in Israeli prisons or something, right? Well, let's say that everybody agrees that this is a war crime, you know, not good or whatever. Let's say that Israel prosecutes Donald Trump. Let's say they prosecute Netanyahu and then they put him in jail for this, for life or whatever bullshit, right? This would be considered satisfactory in terms of international law goes. The only time the ICC or the ICJ are supposed to take a pass at things is when the domestic systems have failed. So the only reason I bring this up is because the idea of carving out things in US law for the ICC and the ICJ to rule on is like almost admitting like a failure of U.S. law, which I think is a strange kind of position to put us in. Yeah,
I think it's fair to say it's a strange position to put us in. But would you not describe this as a failure of U.S. law?
Yeah, I mean, I agree. But you're talking about embedding now in U.S. law a failure of U.S. law.
Sure. And like, I am not blind to the political challenge that comes with this. However,
I'm not even talking politics. I'm just saying from a structural thing. You're basically saying that like, if the ICC or the ICJ has to step in to prosecute, it means that your domestic system has failed. And you're talking about building in a rule for the domestic system failing, which just seems kind of like weird, I guess.
Well, but I think I agree with you in the sense that like it's weird. It would be weird to do that prospectively, right? I think doing it retrospectively and in a response to a failure and an acknowledgement that any correction of that failure internally is just as subject to failure as things that led it here, right? As I kind of pointed out, the external nature of it is why it's so useful. It's the same reason why having a Supreme Court help break up log jams and issues at state court levels, right? Because you have this outside factor that can come in and resolve that issue. And here we're saying we're going to introduce that. Now, maybe there's a way to kind of soften the edges of it and get us to what you're talking about. I mean, we've kind of workshopped it a few different ways. Like one way that could happen is like if we have a extradition treaty with a country that signed onto the Rome Statute, they could charge Donald Trump for crimes within their nation. We could extradite him under a treaty that allows us to extradite pardoned persons to that country. He would be arrested, tried, and held there. And then as a prisoner of that nation, even though he's a citizen of the US, he could be brought then to the ICC, charged and all that stuff, right? So then you would kind of remove this kind of failure of the state aspect of it. Because we have kind of like discussed similar things to what you're talking about. And it's all very remote and it's all very like a lot of shit has to fall into place and things like that. And I think it's more of an idea on my side where it's like whenever I'm talking to someone like a Hutch or Wick, right? It feels to me where it's like the only way this gets called illiberal or it gets called like breaking the rules is because they just have no desire to actually pursue that line without.
I understand what you're saying. I'm like war crimes is like, what are we talking about prosecuting here? Because as hard as it would be to hold people accountable domestically, well, like what are we talking about for war
crimes?
Like,
well, he's got crimes against humanity, war crimes, crimes of aggression. Like he could easily fit. You could easily fit him, Hegseth, Noam, and then a few others.
I don't like Christy Noam because most of her stuff is domestic. Maybe Hegseth and maybe Donald
Trump. You can do domestic crimes against humanity and domestic war crimes in the ICC. We're still working on briefing a lot of the ICC cases that have already happened to get a better understanding of that. I was going to wait to do all that before I talk to you about it, but you got this debate coming up, so I kind of wanted to pick your brain before it. And I mean, the biggest question is jurisdiction. So like your first issue with it was correct to like bring that up, but you know, kind of how you then kind of would dissemble those crimes. I mean, I think to me, before the Iran war even, I was still kind of like, I don't know if the international community would have the appetite for this. Like seeing how much pain the Iran war is causing everybody, I think that there would probably be a huge appetite internationally for us to do something like this. How that expresses itself and how we'd have to get there, I don't know. To me, the other side of that, the other good reason why I would advocate for this if I was in an argument is that I don't have to have a court packing discussion like you just had. I don't have to have a discussion about the filibuster. I don't have to have a discussion about norm breaking within the United States and things like that, where I feel like there's a lot of hand wringing from fellow liberals about how scary it is that we're going to break norms to find accountability.
Yeah, but I feel like this would be an even bigger norm break. You're talking about giving the international community jurisdiction over prior U.S. leaders. I don't know if this ever happened in all of the history of the world.
Well, it's norm breaking only in the sense that it's novel, but it's not like there is a gigantic amount of
not even just based on
the idea that can't happen.
But literally it is, right? Like you have to rescind the Hague Acts you mentioned before, the USC, whatever, I don't remember the titles, but like you'd have to, we've literally made laws on the books saying that if the ICC were to take U.S. anybody, that we would invade the Netherlands and go take them back. So this would be repealing statutes and everything as well, no?
I agree that it would would be a significant change. But in my mind, like whenever I'm talking about norms, these are changes that are outside the laws. If it's a law, it's not a norm, it's a law.
Sure. Right?
I'm talking about changing laws. And the idea that like, I don't think that our hesitance to join the ICC or our hesitance to hold former presidents accountable is because of norms. We did it with Nixon. We attempted to do it with Trump twice. We've attempted to hold them accountable. This is just a different method of holding them accountable. Uh-huh. This is us changing laws so that we can do so. I think the norm breaking is an idea that we would sign on to an international community. But to me, that's more of the, we need to be more institution pilled. And that includes us signing on to international institutions. This is more of a kind of like a platform position. And I think that is norm breaking, but it is norm breaking in the good way. Like it was a norm breaking move to make slavery illegal, right? I think it is a norm breaking move to join into international conventions, but it is a good norm breaking, right? Like that's kind of the angle I would bring it in at.
Okay. That's an argument.
Okay. Well, you were nice about it. I got a lot further in the conversation than other people in our group said I would. They thought you were going to be way more poo-poo about it.
How do you feel about my idea that everybody's always going to be under oath if they're in public service and at the media?
We got to talk a little bit about that before, but I had to go because I have a real job, which like I actually do need to go pretty soon for that too. But wow. No, I like the idea. And like I said before, I think it should be like always on the record, but if they want to get off the record, they can like make a very explicit statement to the journalist and the journalist has to like explicitly report it in any kind of reporting. But I'm not sure what, like, whenever you say that, like, what do you think you're gaining whenever that happens? Like, what do you think?
They'll just know if somebody's lying to you or not.
If someone lies in that capacity. Oh, you mean like if they lie there, like you could, like they could be tried for perjury.
Oh yeah, big time.
Okay, I'm sorry. I thought there was like some other aspect to it. All right. I mean, I need to know more about perjury now. You charge someone with that and things like that, because I don't really deal with that much. But it's also kind of a thing where like, I would wonder, outside of the perjury thing, making everyday readers care about whether or not they're on this kind of official record. I don't know how much that would affect
Media
environment.
Well, I mean, like if people could be held criminally liable for things I say to the media, I think that they would say much better things to the media.
People would be careful with their words.
Okay. Let's say I am a politician. I go out there and I lie.
Not revolutionary. Thank you for the 24-month resub.
And then later I retract it. Okay. And say, oh, I didn't mean to say that. I meant to say this. Because like, let's say you go to a deposition and you answer questions, you're under oath, you're on the record. But if you make a mistake, you are allowed to errata that and say, oh, actually, I didn't mean to say that. There's limits to it and things like that. But you know, like, I feel a little worried about it because I feel like there's a lot of like weaselly ways around it. But I will say, hold on.
I mean, like, depending on what questions you're answering, you can't escape lying at every single answer to deposition by saying, oh, I didn't mean that. Right?
You can't do it for every single one. Sure. Most politicians aren't as bad as Donald Trump, where I would feel like most politicians, they lie in the important parts, but tell
the truth. Let's say that you're in front of the camera, you have to be under oath. Okay.
To be clear, I'm generally under oath almost any time I am talking.
Christy Noem comes out and says that Renee Good was a domestic terrorist, and you decide that you believe she's perjured herself. So the DOJ brings a criminal indictment against her for that. Now she has to demonstrate why was there any record or anything that showed that as being the case. And then if there's not, then she'd just be guilty of lying. Perjuring.
I agree. I like this, but I think that what needs to come with it, this is kind of stupid, but I actually think it would be a really good companion to it, is like, we need the government to define its term, right? Like whenever Christy Noem says she was a domestic terrorist, I feel like you would get into this thing like, well, what does domestic terrorist really mean? Blah, blah, blah. Because like in a normal conversation, you might, but like the DHS secretary saying someone is a domestic terrorist needs to have a very specific meaning to it, right? Like in the same sense that like if I use a specific term in a legal document and a judge reads it, they'll go, oh, that means this thing that we all know it means. But whenever you're speaking to the press, right, like a DHS secretary was saying someone's a domestic terrorist, I feel like people would be willing to give her, especially people on her side, would give her the benefit of the doubt. So like if it was a sense where it's like, okay, Christy Noem said she's a domestic terrorist, under the DHS's definition on the record, it means this, and we can prove that that person was not that specific definition.
Sure, you can have them define it. I feel like it would, sure.
Yeah, I feel like that would help have the bite that I would want it to have. Because otherwise, especially when it comes to like speech and things like that, and when people are speaking to each other, there's a lot of kind of like, oh, well, like we have to show she really meant it, or what the term meant in that moment, right? And stuff like that. And I feel like since these are government officials, holding them to a specific definition within the context of their position makes a lot of sense. So like, I would want to pair it with that so that we could hold them accountable. But yeah, no, I see it.
Yeah, good.
Mr. Mooten, you were right.
True.
Glad I listened to you. You also... So you need to get better about your card management in Slay the Spire. It's really, just saying.
But I won that run, so it doesn't matter.
It's frustrating because, I mean, you still win. So it's like, I'm just a min-maxer kind of just cringing in the chat. So anyways, all right. You guys have a great one and good luck in your debate, Destiny.
Yep. Be careful.